So it's my great pleasure to introduce Ken Mayer, who's going to be talking to us to continue the optimizing the HIV prevention continuum. And he's going to be talking about what will it, PrEP 2016, what will it take to generate demand, increase access, and accelerate uptake. And I know you're not going to let me talk long about you, but as most of us know, Ken is the medical director and co-chair of Fenway Institute. But what I really like to say about Ken is he's really the person that has like 2 degrees of separation for all of us. If he wasn't your direct mentor, he was someone that mentored your mentor. If he wasn't your mentor, he might have been your colleague. If he wasn't your colleague, he was someone that you read an article from and it changed the path of your career. So here's someone that has really influenced all of us, and it's a great pleasure to have him here again. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Rebe. That was just a very euphemistic way of saying that I'm one of the more senior people in the room, but it's all good. I want to thank Rebe and Mike and IAPAC for giving me this very daunting task. This is one of these sort of what's going to happen in the future kinds of talks, which is a little bit challenging. Much more comfortable coming back to this meeting and saying, what are the newest and latest drugs or what is our specific work? So I'm going to be trying to touch on a lot of different people's work and try to think the way forward. But it is kind of daunting. So I don't know if it's a crystal ball or through a glass darkly that we're going to go forward. So the bottom line is PrEP works. It's effective if you take it. So that's incontrovertible. And then the other questions that some of the people had concerns at the early studies was, well, what happens in the real world? And I think the experience at Kaiser Permanente is very informative. You can say it's a more middle class, it's not as ethnically diverse a practice, but still it's real clinical care, not a research study, and basically with a 388 person years of follow-up, plenty of STDs, no HIV. So we don't really have to question whether PrEP works in the real world. We know that it does. The question is, how do you create the enabling environment to support PrEP in the real world? And so if PrEP works, why isn't it the standard of prevention, the SOP? So obviously we know there's been a lot of disinformation and misinformation. We don't have to name and shame here today, but certainly there are groups that have been very counterproductive, but there's a lot of individual attitudes. We also have to understand that there are many phobias that really play into the whole issue of PrEP. When I talk about sex phobia, that's both homophobia, but it also is a phobia about talking about sex, and that's very very much an issue in clinical encounters, a sex taboo. Some of that may be transference kind of worries about clinicians not maintaining the appropriate professional distance. It has to do with people not being comfortable outside of clinical encounters talking in real ways about their sex lives and discussing their potential risks or their desires for optimal and fulfilling sex lives. Certainly in terms of gender issues, both transphobia and challenges that very often providers have about women's sexuality are also issues that impede PrEP uptake in a normative environment, and certainly discomfort around substance use. So clearly some of the interventions have to be at a systemic level in a clinical encounter. There's also a whole issue of institutional inertia. There's not places that are logical PrEP clinics automatically. If you think about it, generalists, as my colleague Doug Krakauer like to talk about the purview paradox. I mean, primary care providers are not used to spending lots of time asking people about their sex lives and sort of strategizing, unfortunately, although they should. Infectious disease specialists who are very familiar with antiretroviral drugs are not necessarily comfortable talking about sex in general and talking about this with HIV uninfected people. So PrEP is a system disruptor, and therefore, if we're thinking about how to increase uptake and scalability in the U.S. and around the world, we have to think about different models. And certainly for some people, it is not a standalone intervention. So we know that people at risk for HIV may have increased risk for multiple syndemic conditions. So they may be more likely to be depressed. They may have experienced violence in their youth. They may have substance use issues. So it's not just simply a pill necessarily. If you're going to provide optimal PrEP or prevention care, you need the package of services. Now, I'm going to contradict myself throughout this talk as well, in the sense that some people very much know what they want, i.e. the pill, and may not need a whole lot of monitoring. And if we want to scale PrEP up and make it affordable, we also have to have streamlined systems as well. So we need to think in parallel ways for some people needing much more than just PrEP and other people trying to make it as simple as possible. And then if we're thinking about us as a global village in terms of trying to deal with curtailing the epidemic, we have to realize that there are lots of regulatory hurdles. And some of them are as simple as country X says, well, we don't know in our culture if this is going to work. And I just was in a consultation, a PrEP consultation in India last month, and that was very much the tenor. We can't really take any of the data from other places because we are different. But the times, they are changing. So we've all seen these data several times at this meeting about the CDC's estimate that about 1 million people in the United States could benefit from PrEP. And indeed, there are encouraging data. Last year, Stacey Bush from Gilead showed this figure about the increase tendency, but again, relatively small level. I actually asked Stacey and colleagues at Gilead, would they provide updated data, and they're not quite ready yet, but hopefully it will be presented at a meeting later this spring or summer. But certainly the data suggests a secular trend, that there has been over the last year or so a major increase in PrEP uptake. Data presented at the retrovirus conference from the CDC and colleagues at Emory University, they did a series of web surveys starting in May 2012. The last wave was November 2014 to March 2015. And you can see the figures, big marked increase in San Francisco. This was 16% of the people who answered the survey. Al Liu presented data suggesting that the figure might be even closer to 30% of those at risk. Part of these numbers are going to be, you know, tricky. It's Mark Twain's lies, damn lies, and statistics. It's not, you know, because you don't know what your true denominator is. You're really not enumerating on a daily basis what people's risks are to know what percent. So you may know how many people are using PrEP through looking at pharmacy records and other proxies, but the true denominator of who would benefit from PrEP is not even a stable number necessarily day to day, certainly over periods of time. But you can see San Francisco, as usual, is in the lead in terms of the most recent data from this survey. Washington, D.C., New York City, also quite high levels of PrEP uptake, over 10% uptake. Other cities, Boston, Chicago, L.A., also pretty high in the 6 to 8% range. But also call your attention to, let's see, with the pointer. Yep. Better not play with the pointer. You can see at the far end of the slide, rural areas, we have, you know, a cultural divide of people not having as much uptake or access, and other non-urban areas. So clearly, the concerns about antiretroviral apartheid, whether for treatment or for prevention, is a concern that different segments of the population may not equally benefit, but certainly data suggesting a marked increase in uptake. Our own experience at Fenway Health has certainly been instructional. Certainly, starting off with having done some of the initial safety studies more than a decade ago, in 2011, when PrEP was first able to be prescribed five people to more than 960 starts last year, quite impressive. And as those of you who went to the breakfast session, my colleague Alex Gonzalez, that still is probably about a quarter of those who might benefit from PrEP at Fenway. So we haven't hit saturation point yet either. We also are seeing an increase in sexually transmitted infections. But again, our feeling is that this is a prevention package. And these are individuals, many of whom would have STDs otherwise. So for example, among our new syphilis cases, half of the individuals are HIV infected. So it's not just PrEP alone. And PrEP, if anything, thing means people are coming back for regular screening, and we would hope that eventually we might screen sufficient number of people to actually see decreases in the number of incident STDs. So I don't see that as a negative reason for reconsidering PrEP rollout. When we looked at back of the envelope calculation about the people who became infected, we had more than 93 individuals who were stable patients at Fenway, had documented negative HIV antibody tests, who subsequently seroconverted while in clinical care. And the denominator there, I put 4,247. These are individuals who self-identified as men having sex with men. Not all those individuals were risky. So even that case, with a larger denominator, which would drive down your incidence, incidence was over 2.2% per year for those who didn't have access to PrEP. We had five individuals who started PrEP who subsequently became HIV infected, and that incidence was 0.8%. So if you do the math, the p-value in terms of the protective effect in the real-world setting at Fenway was less than 0.001. So certainly seeing, again, a sustained effect of PrEP as a benefit in a real-world setting. But PrEP is very labor-intensive, just to get to the point of putting people on PrEP. So my colleague, Phil Chan, who runs the STD clinic and PrEP program at the Brown Miriam Hospital's Immunology Center, shared these data. So they had about 1,000 people visiting for either PrEP consults or having STD symptoms in Providence this period in 2014. And of those individuals, they thought about 234 people merited counseling around PrEP. But it actually got to the point of only 25 individuals starting PrEP. So even of that subset, only about 10% of people going on PrEP. This is not necessarily a failure of the system, because certainly these counseling and education sessions are part of the prevention process. Some of those individuals might, without the counseling, been at greater risk. And just the simple act of thinking about PrEP may be a behavioral intervention in and of itself. But you can certainly see that there also are other impediments. So I'd like to say that treatment as prevention is wholesale. In other words, as soon as you find somebody who's HIV infected, you'd like to help that person get to readiness to initiate treatment. PrEP is retail. PrEP is something that is, you know, on a case-by-case basis that has to be individualized in order for it to be successful. So I want to just take a little bit of a global detour and then go back to some of the things that are going on that are exciting. So some postcards from, I think, the cutting edge. So PrEP rollout globally is a work in progress. So some countries hosted efficacy trials, and some of them have moved very quickly into implementing PrEP, and others are still dragging their heels. And some communities are more engaged than others, and there's a regulatory vacuum. So my first case in point will follow. So we have to think about the fact that we're in the stage of where we have different points in terms of readiness. It's almost like Prochaska's states of change at a national level, where some places are post-trial access. They've just finished the studies. Others have open labels still going on. Others have demo projects, and others are really scaling up PrEP, and it's all happening all at the same time. AVAC has a wonderful website that keeps track of this in real time, so avac.org for any of you who want to be looking at what's happening globally. So this was one of their latest metrics in terms of the number of different open label demonstration and feasibility and implementation studies underway around the world. The number of regulatory approvals has actually changed recently. France has approved, Australia has approved as well. So there are, it's a moving target. But let's take case in point, the United Kingdom. So the PROUD study was really a spectacular success, very real world. Men coming into an STD clinic offered to be getting PrEP right away or to be on a wait list while getting counseling, getting post-exposure prophylaxis. There were three individuals who had immediate access to PrEP who became HIV infected. Two individuals were not adherent over more than 250 people in the sample. One person was in the process of becoming HIV infected when they first came into the study, but the incidence in the control group, in the observation group, who knew that they were at risk for HIV, almost 9%. So from a cost-effectiveness standpoint, number needed to treat, if you gave 13 men PrEP in that setting, you would prevent one new HIV infection every year. So really spectacular success. So what happens? The United Kingdom National Health Service says, well, you know, PrEP is a boutique intervention, and we have to think about our national budget, and we're not so ready to move forward. So unintended consequences, well, it led to some activism, which is a good thing, and they're still reconsidering, and this is not a done deal. But one other consequence, which I think we're going to have to track over time, a few years ago when people said, well, people may be sharing and there may be diversion, I said, well, that's an urban myth. But this is a real website, www.iwantprepnow.co.uk. And if you go on that website, they show several different pharmacies where you can do mail order. You can get generic Tenofovir or FTC into the UK. It's totally legal. And it, if you get a 3-month supply, it's £125, so £500 a year. So for some people, that'll be economically onerous. For many people, it won't. So I think this kind of regulatory delay may lead to more downstream consequences that we don't want to see. Latin America, somewhat different story. The IPREC study was conducted in Ecuador, Peru, and in Brazil. Peru and Brazil have had demonstration projects. We're involved in a project right now with colleagues at UCLA and Impacta in Lima, looking at provision of PrEP for transgender women. Their national project in Brazil at several sites, led by Beatrice Greenstein, going forward. And now Unitaid will be supporting a PrEP demonstration project in Mexico, Peru, and in Brazil. So regular rollout in some of the countries, but obviously Latin America is a huge part of the world, so there are many countries where it hasn't moved forward, but at least there are some innovator programs within the national systems in Latin America. In Asia, APCOM, community-based consortium of organizations working in sexual health and in HIV prevention, had a convening last year, brought in some international experts, got colleagues from WHO. The thought leader there is the Thai Red Cross has a PrEP program. They have several programs that are clinical studies. They also have a out-of-pocket program for PrEP, which is around $30 a month for full monitoring and access to PrEP. They've also taken the lead in starting to put out culturally appropriate native language materials in Thailand. There are programs that are being getting underway in Vietnam, China is beginning the process, and as I mentioned, India is sort of in the pre-contemplation state, at least having active consultations. South Africa, these data were presented or were shared by Brian Kanyemba, who worked with the Desmond Tutu AIDS Foundation, has been a PrEP activist, and there is an increased consciousness about PrEP among MSM. The government has approved limited use of PrEP for female sex workers and has demonstration projects now going on for men who have sex with men, as well as young women and specifically sex workers. And they're also looking at task-shifting projects. So some of the projects involve nurse initiation of PrEP through the Inova clinics in Johannesburg and in Cape Town. So definitely forward movement there. And very recently, there was a convening in South Africa. So this was AVAC, IRMA, WHO, Sister Love, I believe, Daison? What? Not in spirit. Okay. So there a variety, coalition, but these are activists from all over sub-Saharan Africa who are trying to see how they can implement PrEP in their own countries. So lots of movement going on globally. So getting back to the question at hand, how do we improve outcomes in the PrEP cascade? So I want to just touch on a few examples, some of which have already been discussed at this meeting. So paying for PrEP-related services, PrEPDAP, you know, at Fenway, for example, when I asked Alex, how many different insurance schemes do we have paying for PrEP? Over 60, you know, because everybody has different kinds of insurance, you know, different plans, bronze, silver, gold. Another issue, academic detailing, very exciting, is something that local activists could certainly replicate in their own communities. Other opportunities for PrEP ed, PrEP navigation, local champions, we each can make a big difference in our community, PrEP apps that are being developed, other online resources, and certainly thinking about what we can do to really educate colleagues who are providers, and then tailoring for key populations. So paying for PrEP. The CDC recently came out with a very nice brochure, so if you go to the CDC website and keyword PrEP, you can find access to this. And it basically, it's sort of a, it could be printed out as a threefold, and the central page, I think, is really interesting, and also, again, another, well, the first word that comes to mind, indictment of our healthcare system, in that, you know, we have such a complex system, so What's very interesting is the two key opinion leader states in this regard are Washington State and New York State. So in Washington State, the PrEP-DAP program subsidized the cost of the medications for people who are in various underinsured, undercompensated stages. And New York found that the cost of other kinds of services was too much, so created the assistance program in New York State. This diagram sort of says, if you're in this state, or how can you access the Gilead Medication Assistance Program, which is really consists of several assistance programs. So it again brings back the issue that if you have a lot of self-efficacy, you can pretty much find ways to access PrEP. So self-efficacy is good, and then the other thing is, if you're moderately poor and you're in a red state, you're screwed. That's the other thing that you can take from this. Fold, because if you're just above five times the federal poverty limit as a single person, so if you make $59,000 a year and you're in a red state, you have very poor insurance, you have very little access, as opposed to if you're in one of the federal programs, Medicare, Medicaid, or make more money or have a decent insurance program. So clearly, regulatory reform around the insurance issues needs to be a continued source for activism. Academic detailing. This was first discussed by Dimitri Deskalakis in New York City. It's something that San Francisco is doing in other jurisdictions, and very exciting. And New York has it so systematized. So actually, if you go to their City Health website, you can find out under resources that they have public health detailing kits, not just for PrEP, but for other health conditions. So the whole idea of detailing was the whole idea that somebody from pharma would to get busy doctors to learn about a new medication would come in and buy people lunch. Many practices, many states, that's not legal anymore. But the idea of building rapport and in a more informal context where people have to eat, discussing issues was really the norm. So these academic detailing kits will provide tools for taking sexual histories, talking about screening, and then just going back Q&A about PrEP and PEP. So a really nice approach, but something that I think can be tailored in other settings as well. Education. We're fortunate at Fenway. HRSA has funded a National Center for LGBT Health Education led by my colleague Harvey Macadon, and Gilead has provided some additional support for PrEP education. So we have active PrEP webinars going on very often, and if you go to lgbthealtheducation.org or thefenwayinstitute.org, either way you can get access to archived webinars that are still widely available, or the schedule of upcoming programs. But, you know, this is not unique. All the AIDS education training centers and many of the prevention training centers now funded respectively by HRSA and by the CDC have incorporated PrEP as part of their content. So again, it's really getting people motivated to at least know that these resources exist and then to get trained. So becoming a key opinion leader and a local champion is extremely important. The other thing that has gained a lot of attention is the whole idea of health system navigation. And health system navigation, Billy Cunningham, who's here at this meeting, I don't know if he's in the audience this afternoon, but Dr. William Cunningham from UCLA was one of the first people to look at health system navigation for HIV treatment adherence. This approach was first developed by Elmer Freeman, working in Harlem Hospital, and training peers in the community, training black women to work with other black women in the neighborhood, and it increased the rate of screening mammography and decreased the rate of breast cancer. So that data goes back about 30 years. So it's something that can continue to be iterated, and certainly PrEP navigation is something that is being increasingly being used. And the reason I put this up as a slide is that in New York State Department of Health AIDS Institute, they actually have a whole section on PrEP navigation now as part of their catalog of services. So this is becoming increasingly institutionalized and something that we should think of. Now, who pays for the peer navigation is a challenge. Living in a very blue state, we are able to repurpose some of our funds as a federally qualified community health centers to provide for navigation for various services. And with our partner, the AIDS Action Committee of Massachusetts, we can provide PrEP navigation at Fenway, and it is something to think about in other jurisdictions as well. I wanted to give a case study of what a local champion can do. This is a shout out to a colleague, Rupa Patel. Rupa is a young infectious disease physician who cares passionately about trying to increase PrEP by making it available in the St. Louis area. Very red state. So she works with one of the gurus of implementation science, Enola Proctor. So first developed this formative model about to improve supply to create more demand. So she did some qualitative work initially, started thinking what elements of a team do you have and how do you put together this kind of continuum. And it's sort of a beg, borrow, and steal, but I think it's an example of how one person showing some leadership can do. So her university was very supportive of her becoming the PrEP physician and having fellows and other people in training working with her. She worked with one of the NGOs to get an insurance navigator and to help with health literacy. Decided to work with a specific pharmacy that would become the PrEP pharmacy that might cut people breaks who had various insurance challenges. Worked with another NGO to get a prevention specialist up and running, and worked with other community groups to get advocates to talk about PrEP, and then put out educational materials, so ready for PrEP, and basically help people in the community walk through to decrease the barriers. So it's a work in progress, but I think this is an example of what can be done in local jurisdictions, because again, since we don't have a national system, and certainly in this crazy election cycle, we wouldn't want to wait for anything to happen, and I think the more you can create facts on the ground in your own community, the better. The other issue is the internet. So Patrick Sullivan of Emory University has developed an app called HealthMinder. And HealthMinder is a sexual health app for men who have sex with men to try to make various prevention services accessible. So it's still in the pilot phase. We're working on adapting it also for younger people. But he did a pilot in Atlanta and Seattle and enrolled a group of individuals who were over 18, were not HIV infected. They had Android capability. And it had a number of different interfaces on the app. And basically, it gave people a bunch of quizzes about different technologies that they might want. They found that a lot of the men were not happy with the condoms they had. So they would send them different kinds of condoms. And the men found the condoms that they liked. So that was helpful. They also started a process of home self-testing. And that was of interest. And about 10% of the individuals who had not thought of PrEP just in their contact with the app decided to initiate PrEP. So certainly interface with the internet is one way forward. The internet is already a step ahead of us, though. So in addition to Patrick's app, there's actually a commercial app now called NURX, N-U-R-X. I've not had contact with them, but they are an app that was providing contraceptive technologies to women at home, where you could order and there would be a physician who would review your self-described history online, and you could get the mail order to you. And many insurers would actually cover the cost of the contraception. So they are now starting a PrEP function in San Francisco, and they say they're going to soon increase it to New York. So it'll be interesting. And part of my intent today is to try to encourage people maybe who have ideas for research studies. Somebody wants to start working with NURCS to find out, you know, who are their clients and whether this is a net positive or negative. The one other app I just want to mention that will be coming online in the near future is a project that Al Liu and Hyman Scott, Susan Bookbinder, have been involved in called SexPro, which is sort of like a Fitbit for your sex life in terms of having a lot of ratings and assessments, and that also includes some functionality about your appropriateness for accessing PrEP. So I think new technologies in PrEP is definitely the way to go. There already are a huge number of resources. If there was one to remember, I'd say it would be avac.org. And the one web resource I didn't mention is PrEP Facts Facebook group, very active online discussion, and certainly one that when people ask me about PrEP and they just want to hear some of the dialogue that people who are consumers are having about PrEP, it's a very useful group as well. But all of these are great. The AIDS Foundation of Chicago, IRMA, led by Jim Pickett, has some wonderful videos posted on their website. So these are all very useful things to help make the reality of PrEP more real to people. One of the last points I want to talk about is we've met the enemy and they are us. That's POGO, which is probably before many of your time. But clinicians. So my colleague Doug Krakauer has been doing surveys over the last few years, and this is one of the more recent surveys. This is infectious disease specialists from around the U.S. who are part of a network that tries to keep up on the latest epidemics. And so this was an online survey that they answered. And the concerns here are that these individuals, although the majority, 68%, said that they thought that PrEP would be part of their clinical role, only about a third last year had prescribed PrEP among this group of individuals. Also concerning was the fact that many of these individuals felt that if somebody was actively using substances, they would not be inclined to prescribe PrEP for them. So this kind of judgmental way in which providers presume things very, very quickly about patients and limits access is a concern and something we really have to work on to increase access to PrEP. The other issue is just the challenges for people to talk about their sex lives. So these data from a different national survey, an online survey of men who have sex with men, basically interviewed people, said, are you comfortable talking to your doctor about sex? 42% of these individuals said they were not comfortable talking with their provider about MSM sex. And actually, it was very concerning that even when people were comfortable, very few had talked to their provider about PrEP of these individuals who had described at-risk behaviors. And most of them thought that their providers would be unwilling to prescribe PrEP. So there's also kind of an interjection of sort of an anticipated rejection or anticipated judging that really is impeding consumers' willingness. So I think part of our work to get PrEP more accessible is working with the community to make people feel more comfortable to realize that this is part of their patient's bill of rights, access to these medications. We could spend all day talking about tailoring PrEP for key populations. I just want to note that we don't know what best practices are for some populations. Sipil Hosek has led two studies, ATN-110, which was 18 to 22-year-olds, and then ATN-113, the similar protocol for 15 to 17-year-olds. And some of the key findings, cohort was very diverse. Majority were men from communities of color. They were offered an individual behavioral intervention or group behavioral intervention. In either event, HIV incidence was much higher than what we would like to see, 3.3%. Now, an earlier study that we did in the HIV Prevention Trials Network, if you looked at focusing on black men who have sex with men, where PrEP was not available at that point in time, if you looked at the less than 30-year-olds, the HIV incidence was almost 9% per year. So 3.3% is better, but still not acceptable. So tailoring PrEP for youth is still a major research agenda. HP1073, led by Darrell Wheeler and Sheldon Fields, was a PrEP demonstration project for black men who have sex with men in Los Angeles, North Carolina, and Washington, D.C. They trained peer individuals to provide client-centered care coordination, and they found that HIV incidence was lower in those individuals who elected for this C4, the client-centered care coordination. It was not a randomized trial, but certainly suggesting that having people of the community and providing for social service unmet needs is a good way to ensure that PrEP will be more successful, will be more efficacious. And we've heard several times at this meeting, for women at risk for HIV, we don't have good data about PrEP. At least at the present time, there's a demonstration project in the Bay Area for transgender women. For at-risk women who are 30% of the new HIV infections, researchers have really been stymied to come up with optimal project. There was a study called HP10064, which was looking at markers of HIV incidence in women who were selected because they lived in areas of high HIV prevalence. But HIV incidence overall in that population was 0.25%, which is you don't want it to be anything, but it's still quite low. And if you start then doing the math of how do we do an intervention trial to have an adequate sample size, it became kind of a budget buster. So it's been a kind of impasse where the NIH and companies and others have not put in the support. So we really do not know what are best practices for providing PrEP for women. Part of this is helping women figure out their risk, because many of the women in the U.S. who become infected are serially monogamous, and it's not, so it's really knowing the characteristics of your current partner or recent past partners that's the key. It's not some kind of rubric of focusing on STDs or focusing only on sex work, because that doesn't explain the majority of the new infections among women. So again, we still have a long way to go in that regard as well. So a few other musings just to leave you with. What about planned prep programs? So building on the Planned Parenthood model. In fact, there are some Planned Parenthood groups that are offering PrEP because they feel like they have a comprehensive sexual health model. But in some places, it may be a program that builds an array of services around sexual health, includes PrEP as part of that. That may be a way to scale up PrEP in some communities. On the other hand, as I said earlier, there are some individuals who know what they want. They do not like condoms. They know that they like having sex, and they also are highly regulated. There are people who have sexual repertoires where they know when they're going to drink their glass of Chardonnay or smoke their joint, and they also know when they're going to be able to take their pill. And for those individuals, to build a system that's unduly complex, so you have to come in for a medical visit every 3 months when you're otherwise healthy, doesn't make sense. So Patrick Sullivan's actually working on a home self-testing kit, which includes a video showing people how to swab themselves for gonorrhea and chlamydia, do a finger prick, which could be used to measure tenofovir levels, syphilis, and HIV testing. And so people could limit the number of visits and perhaps the cost of visits. And the point is, we need different models. Other issues that I think many of us in the professions need to think about are, we need to think about how we can get mandatory PrEP continuing medical education. This is a pipe dream right now, but the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force, which is ultimately the arbiter of what preventive services get paid for, is considering PrEP. When they come out with a recommendation, we all have to be poised to go back to our various organizations and say, providers need to know how to do this preventive service now that it's recommended by the Preventive Service Task Force. We had heard about PrEP ambassadors from Al Liu, local ambassadors. I also think, can we identify favorite stars? You know, I don't know, Anderson Cooper, Don Lemon, you know. But, you know, we thinking about how do we get the discussion of PrEP higher up. How to Get Away with Murder was great, but what about special series of Sanjay Gupta? So again, thinking, any of us who have contacts with the media, of how we can normalize the conversation is really important. And then lastly, knowing that we do have colleagues from pharma here in the room, we do have to think about PrEP costs. And certainly the WHO recently had a consultation in Geneva saying, well, tenofovir FDC is where most of the studies have been done, but we know that 3TC is quite a good drug. Would it be feasible to use tenofovir 3TC, which is a hell of a lot cheaper globally because it's available in multiple generic formulations? This is a conversation we have to have. It's not, none of one thing is the solution, but certainly things that we can do to decrease the cost of PrEP in resource-rich environments, I think, is going to be very important. On the other hand, we also have to keep in mind that PrEP today is PrEP 1.0, tenofovir, emtricitabine, in a single pill. We know from the IPERGAY data that on-demand PrEP, at least in a highly adherent group of individuals who are having sex often, was quite effective. It averaged about 14, 15 pills a month, 86% decreased HIV incidence. The French have a permissive guidance about the use of less than daily PrEP. It's an important conversation for us to continue to have. But again, how to message that for some individuals who may find it easier to take a pill on a daily basis. So we still have much more we have to learn about that. Very exciting drug coming online, which is now FDA approved for treatment, tenofovir alafenamide FDC, decreased nephrotoxicity, decreased bone toxicity. It has not been proven to work for PrEP yet. There are discussions about studies to show it's a utility for PrEP, and this may be a very useful medication, might require less monitoring, but certainly there would be cost implications there. Other drugs like Miravrac are under study as well. And then we have to keep in mind that down the road, people are very excited about the injectables, both monoclonal antibodies and injectable integrase inhibitors, which will raise other questions of access equity, but may also obviate other issues around daily adherence. So in conclusion, PrEP is increasing globally. We still have a lot of impediments on all quarters, but we are seeing best practices, and we have to learn from different parts of the world how things are going. We need new models, and thinking about things like home monitoring, peer navigation, referral clinics, really validating the role of local champions, using the web much more intelligently, and also knowing that delays in access can create more problems with underground or other kinds of use. And this is my rubric, my Rube Goldberg diagram. So for me, it's not a cascade. It's sort of a cyber mechanism in terms of the interactions of the different pieces. But the two I would flag for our attention is trying to get risk assessments better so clinicians ask, do tell, and trying to also think about how we're intelligent about addressing some of the reasons why people are at risk and may need PrEP, whether it's depression, substance use, or relationship dynamics. So with that, I just want to thank all the people who gave me input, and thank you for your attention.